Hello and welcome to this week's Revisiting Old Favourites, when we continue our pilgrimage to Rome in the company of our pilgrim, Hilaire Belloc, on the path to Rome, reading his book of that title. And we're actually today going to come to one of my favourite parts of the book, and for me, the various particular highlights. One is certainly his failed attempt, recklessly, perhaps heroically, but certainly recklessly, to get over the high Alps during a blizzard with almost fatal consequences, and the wounding of his pride that is the consequence of that, which is actually very healthy and metaphorical lessons for us in that. But today we have this, we've been following him penurious, with virtually no money left, reduced to begging, exhausted, and still many miles to go to Milan where he can get some more money. He's become basically in a desperate situation here, and has a dilemma to face. So this what we might call the ordeal of the candles, I think, is a very dramatic moment for me, and I think, you know, beneath the surface we see a deep spirituality in Belloc. And then what are the consequences when that ordeal of the candles resolves the dilemma that Belloc's in? How does he respond to the solution? And again, we see, I think, some real insights into the depths of Belloc's Catholic spirituality, which is often overlooked, actually, because of his sort of bellicose, rambunctious personality. We sometimes do not see the sensitive side. It comes out in his poetry. It also comes out particularly in this passage, which we'll be reading now. So without any further ado, let's continue on the path to Rome with Hilaire Belloc. The road now neared the end of the lake, and the town called Capo di Largo, or Lakehead, lay off to my right. I saw also that in a very little while I should abruptly find the plains. A low hill, some 5 miles ahead of me, was the last roll of the mountains, and just above me stood the last high crest, a precipitous peak of bare rock, up which there ran a cog railway to some hotel or other. I passed through an old town under the now rising heat. I passed a cemetery in the Italian manner, with marble figures like common living men. The road turned to the left, and I was fairly on the shoulder of the last glacis. I stood on the Alps at their last southern bank, and before me was Lombardy. Also in this ending of the Swiss canton, one was more evidently in Italy than ever. A village perched upon a rock, deep woods and a ravine below it, its houses and its church all betrayed the full Italian spirit. The frontier town was Chiasso. I hesitated with reverence before touching the sacred soil which I had taken so long to reach, and I longed to be able to drink its health. But though I had gone, I suppose, 10 miles, and though the heat was increasing, I would not stop. For I remembered the 2 francs, and my former certitude of reaching Milan was shaking and crumbling. The great heat of midday would soon be on me. I had yet nearly 30 miles to go, and my bad night began to oppress me. I crossed the frontier, which is here an imaginary line. 2 slovenly customs house men asked me if I had anything dutiable on me. I said no, and it was evident enough, for in my little sack or pocket was nothing but a piece of bread. They had applied the American test and searched me for money, then indeed they had have turned me back, and I should have been forced to go into the fields 1/4 mile or so and come into their country by a path instead of a high road. This necessity was spared me. I climbed slowly up the long slope that hides Como. Then I came down upon that lovely city and saw its frame of hills and its lake below me. These things are not like things seen by the eyes, I say it again. They are like what one feels when music is played. I entered Como between 10 and 11, faint for food. And then a new interest came to fill my mind with memories of this great adventure. The lake was in flood, and all the town was water. Como dry must be interesting enough. Como flooded is a marvel. What else is Venice? And here is a Venice at the foot of high mountains, and all in the water. No streets or squares, a fine even depth of 3.5 feet or so for navigators, much what we have in the Spitway and London River at low spring tides. There were a few boats about, but the traffic and pleasure of Como was passing along planks laid on trestles over the water here and there like bridges. And for those who were in haste and could afford it, such as take cabs in London, there were wheelbarrows, coaster carts and whatnot pulled about by men for hire. And it was a sight to remember all one's life to see the rich men of Como squatting on these carts and harrows and being pulled about over the water by the poor men of Como, being indeed an epitome of all modern sociology and economics and religion and organized charity and strenuousness and liberalism and sophistry generally. For my part, I was determined to explore this curious town in the water, and I especially desired to see it on the lakeside, because there one would get the best impression of its being really an aquatic town. So I went northward, as I was directed, and came quite unexpectedly upon the astonishing cathedral. It seemed built of polished marble, and it was in every way so exquisite in proportion, so delicate in sculpture, and so triumphant in attitude, that I thought to myself, no wonder men praise Italy, if this first Italian town has such a building as this. But as you will learn later, many of the things praised are ugly and are praised only by certain followers of charlatans. So I went on till I got to the lake, and there I found a little port about as big as a dining room, for the Italian lakes play at being little seas. They have little ports, little lighthouses, little fleets for war, and little custom houses, and little storms, and little lines of steamers. Indeed, if one wanted to give a rich child a perfect model or toy, one could not give him anything better than an Italian lake. And when I had long gazed at the town, standing, as it seemed, right in the lake, I felt giddy, and said to myself, this is the lack of food. I had eaten nothing but my coffee and bread 11 miles before at dawn. So I pulled out my 2 francs and going into a little shop, I bought bread, sausage and a very little wine for 4 pence. And with 1.80 franc left, I stood in the street eating and wondering what my next step should be. It seemed on the map perhaps 25, perhaps 26 miles to Milan. It was now nearly noon and as hot as could be. I might, if I held out, cover the distance in 8 or 9 hours, but I did not see myself walking in the middle heat on the plain of Lombardy. And even if I had been able, I should only have got into Milan at dark or later, when the post office, with my money in it, would be shut. And where could I sleep? For my 1.80 franc would be gone. A man covering these distances must have one good meal a day, or he falls ill. I could beg, but there was the risk of being arrested, and that means an indefinite waste of time, perhaps several days. And time, that had defeated me at the Greece, threatened me here again. I had nothing to sell or to pawn, and I had no friends. The consul I would not attempt. I knew too much of such things as consuls when poor and dirty men try them. Besides which, There was no console. I pondered. I went into the cool of the cathedral to sit in its fine darkness and think better. I sat before a shrine where candles were burning, put up for their private intentions by the faithful. Of many, two had nearly burnt out. I watched them in their slow race for extinction when a thought took me. I will, said I to myself, use these candles for an ordeal or heavenly judgment. The left-hand one shall be one for tempting the road at the risk of illness or very dangerous failure. The right-hand one shall stand for going by rail till I came to that point on the railway where 1 franc 80 will take me, and thence walking into Milan, and heaven defend the right. They were a long time going out, and they fell evenly. At last, the right-hand one shot up the long flame that precedes the death of candles. The contest took on interest and even excitement when, just as I thought the left-hand certain of winning, it went out without guess or warning, like a second-rate person leaving this world for another. The right-hand candle waved its flame still higher, as though in triumph, outlived its colleague just a moment to enjoy glory, and then in its turn went fluttering down the dark way from which they say there is no return. None may protest against the voice of the gods. I went straight to the nearest railway station, for there are two, and putting down 1 franc 80, asked in French for a ticket to whatever station that sum would reach down the line. The ticket came out marked Milan, and I admitted the miracle and confessed the finger of Providence. There was no change, and I got into the train. I had become that rarest and ultimate kind of traveller, the man without any money whatsoever, without passport, without letters, without food or wine. It would be interesting to see what would follow if the train broke down. I had marched 378 miles and some 3 furlongs or thereabouts. Thus did I break, but by a direct command, the last and dearest of my vows. And as the train rumbled off, I took luxury in the rolling wheels. I thought of that other medieval and papistical pilgrim hobbling along rather than take advantage of any willed thing. And I laughed at him. Now, if Moroso, Maladoroso, or any other non-Aryan, anti-Christian, over-inductive, statistical, brittle-minded man and scientist see anything remarkable in oneself laughing at another self, let me tell him, and all such for their wide-eyed edification and astonishment, that I knew a man once that had 56 selves. There would have been 57, but for the poet in him that died young. He could evolve them at will, and they were very useful to lend to the parish priest when he wished to make up a respectable procession on holy days. And I knew another man that could make himself so tall as to look over the heads of the scientists as a pine tree looks over grasses, and again so small as to discern very clearly the thick coating or dust of wicked pride that covers them up in a fine, impenetrable coat. So much for the moderns. The train rolled on. I noticed Lombardy out of the windows. It is flat. I listened to the talk of the crowded peasants in the train. I did not understand it. I twice leaned out to see if Milan were not standing up before me out of the plain, but I saw nothing. Then I fell asleep. And when I woke suddenly, it was because we were in the terminus of that noble, great town, which I then set out to traverse in search of my necessary money and sustenance. It was yet but early in the afternoon. Well, that, for me, is marvellous writing. engrossing. And Belloc at his best in terms of the beauty of the language he uses, the beauty of the soul that's writing those beautiful words. So here we have him in Milan, about to get some money. So we'll see how that changes things. He's been a beggar now, of course, for several days, and we've been accompanying him on the path to Rome. So thanks so much for joining me on this pilgrimage, which has been going on for many weeks now. Please do join me next week. And in the interim, please enjoy another blessed week of Lent.